This is the takeaway for Monday, January 8th, 2018.
Fire and fury, like the world has never seen.
This is the takeaway. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. Fire and fury. It's the phrase President Donald Trump used to threaten North Korea back in August when he spoke from his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. Now, America has spent a weekend with the fire and fury of Michael Wolff's gossipy book about life inside the Trump White House and the president's fitness for office. Well, the president's been tweeting and attacking that book. His staff gave contentious and angry television interviews. But here's the question for this Monday. Which fire and fury is the president of the United States focused on? The book or the real-life, highly consequential developments on the North Korean peninsula today? In a minute, we're going to talk to David Sanger of the New York Times with a new story on North Korea's nuclear program and how U.S. intelligence services missed the North's progress on missiles and failed to predict the nuclear threat that we see today. Fire and fury, indeed. But first, signs that at least some of the fury could be subsiding, for now at least. There's been an ever so slight thawing in the relationship between North and South Korea this week. The Winter Games are coming up, of course, in Pyeongchang, South Korea, and sports diplomacy is bringing North and South together for talks today on how to get more North Korean athletes at those games, a show of Korean unity, at least for the television cameras. But no one thinks that the Olympics is really what's at stake here. Why has the North warmed things up now? What does the South want from these talks beyond a successful Olympics? And where is the United States just days after President Trump assured the world that his nuclear button is bigger and more potent than Kim Jong-un's? We turn to someone now with some answers.
My name is Song Yoon Lee. I'm a professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
Professor Lee told me why this warming between North and South shouldn't come as too much of a surprise.
Sports diplomacy is always a sexy event. It does wonders in melting a bit the mutual negative frozen images between two adversaries. And after a triumphant banner ballistic year last year, it makes sense for North Korea to come down a rung or two on the ladder of escalation and reach out to South Korea. Why? Because South Korea is eager to engage North Korea and to de-escalate tension. In the past, South Korea has given North Korea over $1 billion a year when North Korea would send athletes and hundreds of North Korean female cheerleaders to South Korea. So North Korea wants to get the U.S. to relax sanctions, and the way to do that is to get South Korea to take the lead in relaxing sanctions and returning to subsidizing North Korea.
And this seems to go to the suspicion that many diplomats in the West have, which is that Kim Jong-un is really trying to drive a bit of a wedge between South Korea and the United States, trying to divide that relationship. Just as this warming between the North and the South comes on the same day, Kim Jong-un's statements towards the United States and towards President Trump were particularly belligerent. Do you see a wedge strategy here?
Absolutely. And it's sort of the ancient Chinese strategy of using one to defeat the other enemy, using barbarian against barbarian, as the Chinese say. It makes sense for North Korea to drive a wedge between South Korea and the United States. And the ultimate goal is to, through a combination of nuclear threat and periodically dangling carrots before its neighbors, to get the U.S. to downgrade its alliance with South Korea, its support for South Korea, and one day to evict the 28,000 or so U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. What would that mean? It would mean North Korea would gain in terms of the balance of power in the region, and North Korea would be better positioned to bully, censor, isolate, and perhaps even one day prevail over that other Korean state, one that is far more legitimate, attractive, rich, and so on.
And that's the long view. Let's go back to the short view for just a moment, Professor. What does South Korea want out of this new round of talks? Of course, they want the best Olympic Games possible. They would like a de-escalation in tensions. What else are they looking for?
Well, South Korea, of course, has grown very rich. South Korea is arguably a singular success story in nation building in the post-1945 era. And what that means is South Korea simply has too much on the line, too much to lose in continuing to escalate tension with North Korea. So, yes, South Korea wants to change the dynamics, diffuse tension, and in the short term, North Korean participation in the Winter Olympics would really jazz up the games. It would gain a lot more attention from the international media. Perhaps even the Chinese president or the Japanese prime minister may attend the opening ceremony. It would raise revenue for South Korea, spike up, of course, TV ratings, and create this illusion that inter-Korean reconciliation is now finally here. When you have hundreds of North Korean cheerleaders dancing and clapping hands in sync, rooting on South Korean athletes, and God forbid, even perhaps American athletes, then the people are mesmerized.
Well, Professor, I can't help but noticing before we let you go that you're describing a dynamic, even if it's just around these Olympic Games, where a lot of countries seem pleased with this thaw, North Korea, South Korea, Russia, China, Japan. And there's one country that might not be terribly pleased with it, and that's the United States. Are we isolated here?
A little bit in the short term. And because the U.S. is quite wary of the South Korean tendency to really lunge at North Korea, embrace North Korea, and compromise principles, the United States is a bit isolated. The more Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, comes across as well-meaning, a bumbling, paranoid, incompetent leader perhaps, but basically well-meaning and seeking peace. And at the same time, the more that the U.S. president comes across as bellicose, motivated by machismo, it all works in North Korea's favor. So I think the correct response would not be to engage North Korea in a war of words.
Professor Sung-Yoon Lee, professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
There's the story on some Olympic-inspired de-escalation on the Korean Peninsula, but you can't get to de-escalation without a whole lot of escalation first. And there are strong signs now that the United States failed to predict critical parts of that escalation. The barrage of missile tests that over the last year have given North Korea the ability to deliver a warhead to all corners of the United States, and what it appears now is that U.S. intelligence services missed it. David Sanger is national security correspondent for the New York Times. Hi, David.
Great to be with you, Todd.
David, it's great to have you back. Look, you write that the U.S. intelligence community knew that North Korea would eventually get to the point of being able to deliver a nuclear warhead to the United States, but got the speed and the timing of that delivery very, very wrong. How did they manage to miss the fact that Kim Jong-un was marching forward so quickly?
Well, you know, what's remarkable about this story, Todd, is it's not your ordinary intelligence failure. It's not simple by any means. What's notable when you go back in the record is that if you go back as far as 2000, so 18 years ago, the National Intelligence Council report suggested that North Korea would have an operative ICBM that could be able to reach the United States, an intercontinental ballistic missile, roughly 2015, 2016. And then in 2004, they moved that out to 2019, 2020. Well, pretty good work when you're dealing from more than a decade and a half distance, right? But when they got up close, and just this past year, as President Trump came in, they told the Trump team that the ability to reach the United States with accuracy would still be 2020, maybe even as far as 2022. And in fact, they missed these tests of these Russian-provided or missiles with Russian-provided engines that were so successful this year. And partly that's because it's very hard to get inside the head of Kim Jong-un or inside his inner circle. And that was sort of the tactical failure. They had the strategic direction right. They had the timing wrong.
North Korea has also changed its own technology, solid rocket fuel, harder to detect. Did the technical side of this help lead to a U.S. intelligence failure here?
Well, the technical side is fascinating because the big question has always been, how much can North Korea produce by itself and how much is it reliant on outside suppliers? And the reliance in the past on outside suppliers has been an enormous help to the U.S. The CIA and other intelligence agencies has for years poisoned the supply chain with bad parts thing, and very typical kind of technique that was also used against Iran. There have been, as we reported early last year, cyber attacks directed at the missile program, and those were actually quite effective against an intermediate range missile called the Musadon that had an 88% failure rate until Kim Jong-un killed the program last fall, or a year ago fall. And then what happened was they shifted very quickly to this new design of these much larger liquid-fueled engines at a time that we thought they were going toward solid fuels. And it looks like a lot of that is indigenously produced. And the question is, did we miss their ability to go build up the infrastructure to do it? It's a very difficult thing to do. It took the U.S. years when we did it in the 1950s, and suggests that they've probably had a good deal of outside technical help, probably former Soviet engineers.
Well, David, you talked to the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, who acknowledged that the U.S. had a lapse here, at least in this part of the intelligence. The CIA director, Mike Pompeo, basically denied there was any lapse here. But what about the real impact? Look, you made it clear the United States sort of had the long-term trajectory of the missile program right. It missed the acute details of exactly when North Korea would reach ICBM capability. Even if we had that second part right, would we have been able to stop it? I guess the question is, what difference does it make?
Well, it's a really good question, Todd. So there would have been a series of policy decisions that would have had to have been made, not by President Trump, but by President Obama. And I think one of the big questions here is why President Obama, at a time that he was focused so intently on the Iranian nuclear program, didn't spend more time on the North Korea issue. And partly that's because they saw an opportunity to stop Iran before it got any weapons. North Korea, of course, already had weapons, even if they couldn't deliver them to the U.S., and they viewed that program as something that was mostly irreversible. Now, if they had known earlier, what could they have done? Well, they could have thickened missile defenses earlier on, if you have trust that those work. Some kinds do, some kinds don't. They might have taken the extraordinary steps of closing up the loopholes and sanctions that President Trump has done pretty well this past year, and done that during the Obama years. There's no particular reason it couldn't have been done earlier with better warning. And they also could have accelerated those kind of cyber attacks that I described, which worked in some cases and don't appear to be working now.
The story of how the U.S. intelligence services appear to have missed just how far along Kim Jong-un was in being able to deliver a nuclear weapon to the United States. David Sanger with the New York Times has the story, and it's quite a story in the pages of that paper. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd. Happy New Year.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
And Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Thanks for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and let's go to Israel now, where on Sunday, Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs released a list of 20 international organizations whose members Israel says will be banned from entering the country. Those organizations are involved in international protests against Israel's policies towards Palestinians and Palestinian territories. Israel says it's moving to actively prevent those groups from spreading falsehoods from within the country. Ruth Eglash has been covering the story for The Washington Post. She's in Jerusalem. Hi, Ruth.
Hi there.
Ruth, Israel is banning people from 20 organizations here. What is Israel trying to say?
I think, you know, this is part of an ongoing process that's been ramped up over the past year or two for Israel tackling what's known as the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions effort to put pressure on Israel to change its policies regarding the Palestinians, to try and find a way to end the occupation of the West Bank And Israel actually sees these organizations more as an effort to delegitimize its existence and as more nefarious than what it presents itself. So it's all part of an ongoing process to clamp down or to hit back at these organizations.
Talk a little bit more about BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Who's involved in that movement and what exactly are they doing?
I mean, from what it appears or what it has become, it's a very loose conglomeration of different groups or different groups who have signed on or have pronounced or announced allegiance with this attempt to pressure Israel. And from what we've seen over the years, it's been a mixed effort of boycotting Israeli goods, boycotting particularly Israeli goods that come from the West Bank settlements, Jewish settlements, and also to put pressure on businesses, companies not to do business with Israel, and to put pressure on artists and celebrities to not visit Israel, and particularly the West Bank.
How effective has BDS been so far?
I think that's a matter of opinion. I mean, the BDS claims themselves some very great results from their pressure. Recently, the singer Lord from New Zealand cancelled her performances here. They claim other victories as well. Israel would say, some Israelis would say it's less of an impact. Financially, they would say it's no impact, while other Israelis would say that it has had an impact and it does affect Israel, affect the way Israel is perceived around the world.
So, Ruth, why has Israel, though, chosen to go directly at these groups that protest its policies? Don't they risk a perception that they're trying to silence dissent?
Well, I think that their thinking, I think, is just to say, you know, if this is the way people act towards Israel, then they shouldn't be given the honor or right of visiting, which also includes visiting the Palestinian areas or Palestinian territories. So, I mean, that's, I think, where it's basically coming from. And as I said, it's part of a wider effort to hit back at BDS, to shut it down, to stop it from spreading to more people. And it's a government policy. This blacklist that was announced yesterday is stipulated in law, in legislation that was passed in March. And so that's really where it comes from.
There are a couple of U.S. groups included, including Jewish Voices for Peace and Code Pink. How have they responded?
There's been a very wide range of response. I mean, some of the organizations say that it's actually a badge of honor that they appear on that list. Other organizations, particularly the Jewish ones, Jewish Voice for Peace and Code Pink, feel that it's outrageous that their members or their leaders would be prevented from entering Israel. I saw comments from, I think, the director of Jewish Voice for Peace, who said that it would impact her directly because she visits Israel to visit family members here. So, you know, there's been a wide range of different responses.
And away from these BDS protesters, Ruth, and Israel's decision to ban some of them from its territory, there's been some developments on the international stage. President Trump, a few days ago, criticized the Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, backed up that criticism. Does the United States have the ability to cut funding to this organization? Because that's been the threat.
I mean, from what we understand, I mean, I really don't know about like the mechanics of making a decision to cut that funding. The president has threatened to cut aid. I don't know if he specifically said UNRWA, which is the agency that works with Palestinian refugees. But then also Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., made comments regarding aid to Palestinians via the UN agencies. So it was assumed or it was taken to understand that it would directly impact UNRWA. What we do know is that the US is the largest single donor to UNRWA. And over the past year is among the top donors to UNRWA. So I think if that money is taken away, it could have a huge impact on the work that that organization or agency does in Israel, in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in other countries in the Middle East where there are Palestinian or descendants of Palestinians who still live in refugee-like conditions.
Ruth Eglash, correspondent for The Washington Post in Jerusalem. Ruth, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
A story now from Mississippi, where records show that as of August 2017, more than 100 people sat in county jails waiting for mental health evaluations to determine if their cases can proceed. Now, these people have not been convicted of a crime, and in one case, a defendant was locked up for nearly 4 years without a trial, waiting for an evaluation. The reporting comes from ProPublica, and former ProPublica reporter Sarah Smith says it's a statewide scandal in Mississippi. Sarah's with me now, and Sarah, let's start with 16-year-old Tyler Hare. He's at the center of your reporting. Who is Tyler, and how did he wind up in jail?
Tyler had a long history of mental illness throughout his childhood and stabbed his father's girlfriend in the back with a 10-inch butcher knife. He was arrested in Calhoun County, Mississippi, and wound up in jail as a 16-year-old in an adult jail. He then waited in that adult jail for nearly 4 years without a trial. He didn't get lost in the system. Nobody forgot about him. He was waiting for a forensic mental evaluation to determine whether he was even fit to stand trial. And without that evaluation having taken place, nothing could move forward.
Why didn't it happen? I mean, a wait of a couple of weeks or a couple of months, maybe somebody says these wait times are too long, but you're talking about waits on the order of years. For a young man who didn't fall through the cracks, people knew he was there and knew he needed to be evaluated. What happened?
Mississippi has only 15 state beds with which to conduct these pretrial evaluations and restorations if need be. 15 state beds for the entire state of Mississippi. Tyler did not have medication. He did not have visits from a psychiatrist. He was not regularly treated. This is not a mental ward. It's a jail.
Can you talk about his behavior in jail, what the sheriff and his other jailers observed in him, and whether or not he seemed to be well while he was in there?
Certainly. They saw him as much of the time he was quite docile. Then there was that other part of the time when he said he saw little green men and he heard voices. And he would ask to go into solitary confinement because he just couldn't deal with the voices or the other inmates. Some of the other inmates reported him clutching his feet and rocking back and forth in the middle of the jail cells.
Well, there was a sheriff in Calhoun County who at least was trying to shake the trees of the justice system, calling up to the state hospital on a monthly basis to get Tyler evaluated. What was he told? What was happening there?
He was told that Tyler was third on the wait list, third on the wait list, third on the wait list. Then all of a sudden he calls up one day in the spring of 2016 and he's told without explanation that Tyler has dropped to 10th on the wait list. And he says, essentially, I don't know how you can say that he's dropped to 10th. You've never seen him. You don't know his problems. You've never sent anybody out here. Why is he number 10? And he, again, gets no explanation.
So you started checking out the hospital in question. This is a place called Whitfield, and discovered a lot of problems there, too. What's going on at the state hospital in Mississippi?
Well, the state hospital in Mississippi, in this forensic unit at least, has had the same number of beds and has not been updated since it was built in 1955. And they have been continually asking for more funding, and the state legislature has continually denied it. It is not up to fire code. Paint is peeling. There is mold everywhere. Each cell is secured by individual padlocks, so there's no central locking system. Someone has to go and individually release each one of the inmates, which is obviously an extremely dangerous situation.
So what did the hospital say in response to your reporting, Sarah?
I was not able to interview anyone from the hospital. They sent me a statement and declined to make anyone available. They've said that they're trying to do the best with what they have. They have been starting a new initiative to do competency restoration in a local jail rather than bringing people into Whitfield inpatient, which hopefully can reduce the wait list. And they've said that they've seen some success with that.
And Sarah, where is Tyler Hare now? He was deemed competent to stand trial?
Yes, he was. Tyler Hare is currently serving his sentence in a regional facility as a state prisoner. He took a plea bargain. He is not getting any mental health care there.
Sarah Smith, former reporting fellow at ProPublica. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. Oxygen is critical to life on Earth. You're breathing it right now, of course, but so are all of the plankton and algae and crabs and fish living in the world's oceans. A new analysis now by the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center shows that the ocean is losing that oxygen at an alarming rate and that the number and severity of suffocating ocean dead zones is increasing. Denise Breitberg is senior scientist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center.
What we found by pulling together people who work all over the world and on different topics is really the magnitude of the problem. Oxygen concentrations are declining both in the open ocean and along the coasts.
What causes that decline in oxygen?
There's different causes in different places, but the two major ones are in coastal waters. We have too much nutrients coming off the land from sewage and from agriculture. And then globally, especially in the open oceans, climate change and global warming is what's really causing the loss of oxygen.
What do these deoxygenated zones, these dead zones, look like to a marine biologist? If you were to go to one of these zones and put on your scuba gear, would you notice a difference?
You would definitely notice a difference. And maybe the easiest analogy is to think of a desert up on land. If these were happening where we could see them, we would really be appalled. Where oxygen is really low, marine life just can't thrive. Oxygen is fundamental to life in the oceans. And there are microbes and there are some organisms that are adapted to extremely low oxygen concentrations. But many of the animals that we think of, fish and sea urchins and crabs, really depend on having sufficient oxygen in their habitat in order to use those areas.
So every zone is different, but what happens here? The oxygen goes down, the smallest sea life, the plankton and the microorganisms, many of them can't survive, and then the whole food chain is thrown off?
Actually, it's a bit the opposite. Oxygen concentrations go down, and some of the microbes can thrive in very low oxygen areas, but it's the larger things, the animals that we think of in healthy marine ecosystems that just cannot use these areas.
What are some of the worst affected places? What do they look like?
It differs in coastal areas and in the open oceans. In coastal areas, we think of these large dead zones like in Chesapeake Bay, in the Gulf of Mexico, in the Baltic Sea, where fish avoid them, crabs and lobsters avoid them. And when oxygen concentrations drop fairly quickly, the sea bottom can be literally covered with dead animals. Out in the open ocean, there are actually natural low oxygen zones called oxygen minimum zones. And what we worry about in those cases is the expansion of those areas so that waters that used to be high in oxygen and good habitat for marine life now are transforming into oxygen minimum zones where really only microbes thrive.
And what you're describing in many places sounds, Denise, like kind of a 1-2 punch. Low oxygen plus rising sea temperatures, another problem due to global warming. What are the consequences of that?
Really, the combination of increasing temperatures and declining oxygen is really worrisome. As temperatures increase, the oxygen requirements of animals tend to increase. So that for a 10-degree increase in centigrade in temperature, oxygen requirements of animals will tend to double or even triple. But at the same time, as temperatures rise, the amount of oxygen available to animals declines. So we really worry about the combination of these stressors.
So let's talk about the potential for recovery, which is going to be different depending on where you go. But your research facility there, Denise Breitberger, is right on the shores of the Chesapeake Bay, just outside of Annapolis. The Chesapeake has recovered to an extent over the last 10 to 15 years. How has that happened? Can recovery be engineered? What does it look like?
Well, when the problem is nutrients, we really know what to do. We can improve sewage treatment plants so that nitrogen is not released into the water. We can improve agriculture so that there's less runoff of fertilizer. And a major effect has been, a major beneficial effect has actually been from the Clean Air Act, so that we have less nitrogen coming in from atmospheric deposition that was being caused by fossil fuel burning.
So those are the cases close to the coast with too many nutrients. I guess policy can affect that. What about other areas where maybe nutrients aren't the problem? What's the way into to recovery there?
Well, clearly dealing with global warming is going to take a global effort. And again, we know in general what needs to be done. We need to dramatically decrease the emissions of greenhouse gases. But this is going to be incredibly important, not just for restoring oxygen in the oceans, but for all of the other problems that are being caused and will be worsening as a result of global warming.
Is there a chance that the severity of deoxygenization is even worse than we know because of all the places where we haven't even looked?
One of the really worrisome areas that we suspect has more problems than we know about would be in developing countries. We only know about low oxygen where measurements are actually being taken. And there are a number of areas around the world where we know coastal waters are receiving high levels of nutrients from raw sewage and from agriculture. And we suspect that there are problems there.
Denise Breitberg with the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center in Maryland. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Most of us, let's face it, don't think marine habitat when we think of the shores off of New York City. But for the first time in a century, humpback whales have returned to those waters where they feed before migrating south to warmer Caribbean waters for the winter. Takeaway producer Oliver Lazarus has the story.
It's the first Sunday in November and the last outing of the 2017 season. The sky is gray and misty, with spitting rain, about 45 degrees, and rough waters. The 40 or so passengers aboard the American Princess are getting a reorientation of sorts.
So now I'm going to direct your attention at the right-hand side, starboard side. We're looking over toward Brooklyn.
That's Catherine Granton. She's a naturalist on board the vessel used by Gotham Whale, which is New York City's first and only whale-watching organization, founded in 2011.
We are, so to speak, in the shadow of Gotham City. And yet, we're going out to look for whales and dolphin in their native habitat. That's right, their native habitat.
We're off the far tip of Queens. Whales hunted here were the fuel for growth in parts of New York City, Long Island, and Hudson Valley, until they were hunted nearly to extinction in the early 20th century. Today, the same waters are home to Ambrose Channel, the main shipping channel out of New York and New Jersey, and one of the busiest in the world. But for the first time in a century, whales are back in New York.
We think there's about three reasons why whales are returning to the waters of New York.
That's Paul Cisuerta, president and founder of Gotham Whale.
First is that the influence of the Hudson River is really strong. And in past times, that was mostly pollution that was coming out of the river. Now it's nutrients. Second reason is there are more humpback whales. They recently were taken off of the endangered species list. And the third reason is that there's been some restrictions on the menhaden catch.
Menhaden. That's the type of fish that humpbacks feed on in these waters. Though the catch that Paul's referring to was just increased after this tour. Still, humpback populations have recovered to about 80,000 worldwide, compared to an estimated 10,000 in the mid-1980s. And they're becoming more and more common in waters along the East Coast. Cisuerta, along with his crew of researchers and citizen scientists, have made it their mission to document all the whales that come into New York Harbor. They've counted 75 individuals since 2011, when humpbacks were first spotted again in these waters.
My name is Artie Rasledge, and I'm looking for dolphins and whales. Splashes, blows, huge splashes help.
Rasledge is at the boat's bow. It's his job to spot the whales, photograph them for the New York Humpback Whale Catalog, and also name them. There's Jerry.
Jerry Garcia. I was listening to the dead. There's sparkles. It looks like somebody held the whale, took like sparkles and put it all over him. I love that whale. That's a good one. Let's see. You know, there's Jerry Sparkles. There's New Jersey.
The chance to get a glimpse of New York's newest inhabitants is a big draw for residents and tourists alike.
I'm Giacomo, I'm Italian, and I came here because 2 weeks ago I decided, okay, I want to see whales.
I'm from Italy as well, but I grew up here, and my mom was like, there are no whales off of Queens. Like, what are you talking about? And I was like, well, my friend found this site. Evidently, yes, there are.
Then there's Edie, celebrating her 75th birthday.
Well, actually, it's later this month, but we're celebrating it today so that we can be out on this last cruise of the season. Just the fact that we are privileged to see whales here, that's remarkable, even if I never saw one.
But halfway into the tour, still no whales, and the seas are getting choppy. Below deck, the situation is dire. At the front of the boat, another Edie isn't quite as patient. She's there with her sibling.
Well, we thought we were going to see whales and dolphins, but it turns out we're not. My mom made me do it.
Then the boat speeds up.
It feels like we're flying. I'm thinking there's a whale deer here.
Oh! Yeah!
Wow! Whale!
Yes! That was awesome! Wow, it was all black.
And it feels like we're surrounded.
Oh.
They could be cooperatively feeding. This is definitely the height of the migration. Oh! Lunch feed!
9 o'clock!
There's all this crazy stuff and the throwing up. We came to the back of a whale. Finally.
Humpbacks can reach up to 60 feet in length and weigh between 25 to 40 tons. They're huge. And everyone leans over the rails to catch a seconds-long glimpse of their broad backs or speckled white heads, briefly surfacing before submerging. But in these brief moments, people get a sense of something much larger.
To see the majesty, the intelligence, and the sensitivity in the eye of a whale is truly just touching creation. And at the same time, look, we can see the density of urban humanity over there and those apartment buildings, and here we are. It's this fantastic combination.
In total, 6 humpbacks are spotted. Ciswerda thinks it's younger humpbacks that come here, exploring new feeding grounds that the older generations have learned to stay away from. Big ships and fishing nets have caused collisions and unintentional deaths, a problem that's worse in busy waters like these. And over the past 2 years, a record number of dead humpbacks have washed ashore up and down the East Coast. About 40 through this past April. So many that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declared an unusual mortality event. The cause is currently being investigated. Gotham Whale is doing its part to help mitigate the dangers, alerting nearby ships of their presence and sharing photographs and sightings with other researchers on the East Coast. But there's only so much they can do.
Hopefully, human activity and whales can live together. About to be determined, because this is just the last 5 years or so.
It's Marathon Sunday in New York, and as the American Princess makes its way back to the dock, the outlines of the city skyline begin to emerge. It doesn't fit our idea of what a whale's habitat should be, but they're here, and Edie reminds us that it's largely our choice whether or not they stay.
It didn't happen accidentally. It happened because we made decisions about our environment, decisions that we still have to make every day, decisions about our community of life.
For The Takeaway, I'm Oliver Lazarus.
Well, do you interact with wildlife where you live?
This is Holly Cleveland. We are avid Audubon Portland supporters. They do so much to engage urban folks with wildlife that we encounter. Our kids have gone to their day camps to learn good stewardship and skills in being in the outdoors. We snorkel, hike, kayak, and cycle in places where our world meets the wilder world for our kids' sake.
Hi, this is Michael from Seattle. We have orca whales, bald eagles, otters, a lot of raccoons. And a couple years ago, there was a cougar spotted walking through some of our residential neighborhood.
Hi, this is Catherine in Dallas, and I live near White Rock Lake. And instead of trying to trap and kill the wildlife here, like the coyotes, we also have raptors. We concentrate on protecting our pets. And we keep apprised of all the sightings and all the wildlife activity via the Nextdoor app.
We got this story from Drain, Oregon. I don't normally interact with wildlife, but I saw a red-tailed hawk get hit by a car. I was able to get it before it got hit by another car, and I called Wild Animal Rescue. He's currently recovering from a broken wing. We hope he'll be released soon. Tell us your stories of urban wildlife. Hey, I have one that frankly did not end well. A hotel pool in Agra, India, a few years ago. For humans, it's a pool, but for the local macaque population, a watering hole. And a very valuable one, apparently. We thought that they would share. They thought a lot differently. We wound up in a confrontation with those monkeys. I defended myself with a pool chair. My travel companion ended up bitten and in a health clinic getting treated for bites and lacerations. And yes, half a dozen shots with rabies vaccine. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.